It's 5:06 and you're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up later in the program, we'll look at an effort to provide public funding for Milwaukee parks, along with funding for a new stadium for the Bucks.
First, now that the growing season in Wisconsin is underway, it's a good time to talk plants. We're going to leave the how-to part of it for someone else. Right now, we're getting to know the basics about how plants work and hearing some unexpected stories from the world of botany.
Ruth Kassinger joins us now. She's written for the Washington Post, Health Magazine, and Science Weekly. Her new book is called A Garden of Marvels, How We Discovered That Flowers Have Sex, Leaves Eat Air, and Other Secrets of Plants. Ruth, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Well, you say that this book started with a murder, and this was a murder perpetrated by yourself against a beloved plant. What happened?
I had a kumquat tree. I have a conservatory, a small conservatory off the back of my house, and I had a kumquat tree that I raised inside during the winter and outside during the summer, and it had done beautifully for 8 years. And then I noticed that the leaves were falling off of its lower branches, and taking a hint from my husband, who is an outdoor gardener, I decided to give the kumquat tree a good pruning. And I did that, and she died. And so I felt like I committed a murder and wanted to prevent that from happening again, and figured that there was more to taking care of plants than just reading the hang tags, and that I should understand how they work.
And what is it exactly that you set out to learn about plants?
Well, I wanted to know... I figured that the best way to understand the way plants work would be to follow the story of the very first botanist who figured out the fundamentals of plant physiology. I just wanted to know the basics, nothing too elaborate, but how does water get to the top of trees? How do leaves turn sunlight and carbon dioxide into plant mass? And what about sex? Who discovered that plants have sex, that flowers are sexual organs? And then how does that work, and how would it make me a better gardener?
You know, I remember some rudimentary biology. I remember words like pistils and stamens and, well, actually, that's all I remember about plant biology. But do you mind giving us, you know, sort of the quick rundown about, you know, the parts of a plant and what they do?
Well, if we're talking about the stem, there's, I think, what other people will also remember from their basic biology, if not from crossword puzzles where these words show up. There's the xylem and the phloem. The xylem takes water and minerals up a plant to the top, to the leaves, and the phloem takes the sugars that are made in the leaves and distributes it throughout the plant and ultimately stores the sugars in the roots. And, of course, you talked about stamens and pistils, and stamens are the male organs in the flower. I remind myself of the definition of the word by remembering that stamens has the word men in them, and pistils are the female organs, and at the bottom of the pistils are the plant's, the flower's, ovaries. Hmm.
Well, as long as we're talking about this, of course, the most eye-catching part of the title of your book is the discovery that plants have sex. When did we, botanists, discover that plants have sex?
Well, there were a few hints of it in the late 1600s, but you can really put a date on when more than just one or two people understood that flowers were all about sex. And that date is June 10th, 1717, and the time was 6 a.m. And the man who spread the word was a demonstrator of plants at the King's Garden in Paris. And he knew what flowers were all about. But, of course, at the time, flowers were so highly associated with the Virgin Mary, that people were very reluctant to think that flowers had anything to do with sex. But he gave a famous lecture to medical students at that very early hour, and in essence, it went viral. He didn't get any kudos from the institution. In fact, they thought that was a horrible thing that he'd done. But the word did spread, and within a decade or two, it was generally agreed that indeed flowers were all about sex.
And I don't know if he intended it this way, but I have a little excerpt here from, I think that it is his talk about the plant sex life. And it actually does not sound like we're talking about plants. It sounds like something that is at the least PG-13. And, you know, we're talking about something a lot more, well, you get the idea.
Yes.
I was going to read all of it, but I don't even think I want to. I'm just going to read a little tiny bit to give people a taste. And this is about the male part of the plant, the stamen. And the end of it is, let's see. Upon finding themselves freed, they produce an abrupt general discharge, a swirl of dust spreading fecundity everywhere. They then find themselves exhausted.
Yes.
Does that still hold true today? Is that what it is like for plants to have sex and engage in spreading their seed?
That's exactly how it works. And sometimes it gets, you know, once you start talking about the role of insects, of course, in sex, you can really get down and dirty. You know, you could say that the insects are the only innocent participants in plant sex. They're there to find the nectar, and instead they get, you know, they may find the nectar, in some cases they don't, and they get tagged with pollen and spread it to a neighboring female organ in the plant.
So the insects are sort of the third party here.
Yes.
And they spread it to the female, and the female pistil gets, I guess, fertilized, and then what?
Well, the pollen goes into the stamen, and one of the really remarkable things is that I always thought that somehow the pollen just fell down the stamen or passed down the stamen, but in fact, an Italian, Amici, discovered that the pollen lands on the top of the pistil and sends out a pollen tube, which is like an explorer. It goes down, burrows its way down through the pistil and into the ovary, delivering the genetic material to the ovary. It had been quite a great mystery because everyone had assumed that the pistils were hollow in some way, but in fact they're very solid, and it takes a burrowing to get the genetic material to the ovary.
So knowing what you do about plant sex now, this is one of the things you wanted to find out, knowing that plants seem to have these kind of vibrant, almost violent sex lives, at least if you read this French guy's description. Does it change the way that you think about plants?
Well, I guess I would say yes, because, you know, it tells you that there are all sorts of mysteries in plants, things that we don't think about. Plants are such an ordinary and constant part of our lives. But when you stop to think about how they really work, it really opens your eyes to a great number of mysteries and stories and just exciting insights that give you a better appreciation for the world around us.
Well, we'll be talking about more of those mysteries and insights when we come back. We're talking now with Ruth Cassinger. She has a new book out. It's called A Garden of Marvels, How We Discovered That Flowers Have Sex, Leaves Eat Air, and Other Secrets of Plants.
And we'd love to hear from you. Is there a plant that fascinates you? Are you a careful gardener and you pay attention to these little weird details about the plants you work with? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking to Ruth Cassinger about her new book, A Garden of Marvels, how we discover that flowers have sex, leaves eat air, and other secrets of plants.
And we'd love to hear from you. Is there a plant that fascinates you? Do you have a burning botanical question? You can call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Everything you wanted to know about plants but were afraid to ask. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we left off talking about plant sex, and that kind of gets us into the terrain of plant breeding, I guess. And one interesting quest you went on was to find out what went into the quest for the black petunia, true black petunia, which was not an easy color to get to. Can you tell us about that?
Yes, I went out to Ball Horticultural Company, Ball Seed Company, which is outside of Chicago. And I spoke to the woman who has bred an entirely black petunia. One of the things she told me was that you couldn't have a black petunia without having a green petunia. It turns out that several years ago, maybe by now it's 6 or 7, Ball had sent some white petunia seeds to a grower, and the grower planted the seeds and reported back to Ping, which is the name of the breeder, that most of the flowers had come out white, but one had come out green, and was she interested in the green petunia? Of course, green is not a color of petunia that you can find in nature until that moment, and it turns out that the green petunia was a mutant, and Ping was interested in it. And she bred it into all sorts of other colors of petunia. And at first, she said the flowers came out all kinds of odd, almost dirty colors, one that looked like blue jeans in particular, I remember. And then one day, out of the thousands and thousands that she had planted and crossed and rebred, one came out black. And what she ultimately discovered was that because all of the colors of the petunia, all the possible colors, had been bred into this one individual, the color that manifested was black because it absorbed light of all wavelengths, so that nothing was reflected to the viewer's eyes, and it is indeed an all-black petunia. That visit also gave me the opportunity to understand from Ping what it takes to produce color in flowers, and made me understand some of the funny things that we notice about flowers, that, for example, on a single plant, you may have flowers that are slightly different colors or have narrow stripes and thick stripes. And these are all questions of the genetics and the environment that affect individual flower color.
Now, the black petunia was the result of thousands of tries to get there. Was it replicatable? Is there now a strand of that?
Yes, it is replicatable, but not yet by seed. In order to have black petunias, you need to have cuttings from black petunias. So she was able to produce a few, and then all of the others are produced by making cuttings and then growing those plants, growing the cuttings into more plants.
And you have one, don't you?
I did have one. I did. They don't last for a long time.
Was it beautiful when it bloomed?
Yes. I mean, it's beautiful in a slightly funereal way. It's dramatic. I did think that they looked wonderful in a pot planted with red and white petunias, very dramatic in a sort of Madame X kind of way. I'm not sure that I would like a whole planting bed full of black petunias.
A little bit macabre, but definitely interesting.
A little bit, maybe, though.
Well, let's go to a caller here. We've got Linda on the line from Iron Belt. Hi, Linda.
Hi. My grandpa, as I remember, okay, now I'm getting older, but as I remember, my grandpa back in 64 to 68, he had a greenhouse, and he would sell gladiolas in Okochee, Wisconsin.
Mm-hmm.
And he would sit out there in the wintertime, and he would just cross things over. He would try different things. And he took an award at the state fair at one point for making a green ice. The green ice.
Oh, uh-huh.
And that's a color of gladiola.
Yeah, it was just like a green and like white. Yeah. I don't know.
That sounds beautiful.
Yeah, that sounds lovely. How interesting that your grandfather was doing it, you know, on his own. And is that typical, do you think, Ruth, that most plant growers, or at least some, have the acumen to try to mess around with plants that way and get new colors?
Oh, yes, definitely. I mean, if you're asking, does the average homeowner or gardener know how to do this, or is it a common practice among professional breeders?
Well, maybe either or. It sounds like more professional breeders in this case.
Yes, it is usually professional breeders, but there many of the companies like Proven Winners and other major companies, seed and plant companies, do purchase plants from home breeders. Occasionally, people will, in the course of doing their gardening, come up with a sport, a mutant, or deliberately crossbreed plants to produce a new color. And you can sell those individuals to a breeder and collect royalties.
Well, another plant that you were interested in was something called a citrus cocktail tree. Kind of sounds like a crazy Dr. Seuss plant, but you drove down to Florida, all the way to Florida, to get one. Tell us about these cocktail trees.
Well, a citrus cocktail tree is one tree that has multiple kinds of fruit on it. So I did indeed go to Florida and worked with a man who is a citrus grafter. Almost all citrus trees grow on a sour orange rootstock onto which another kind of citrus, more marketable citrus, has been grafted. But you can also graft onto a single tree lemons, limes, tangelos, navel oranges, and that is what he did for me. Because I was curious, and I thought it would be a wonderful conversation piece. And also, in the space of one tree, you could have five different kinds of fruit.
So you brought one home with you, it sounds like, again, as in the case of the black petunia. What is it like to see all these different fruits appear on a single tree?
Well, I wish I could have brought it home to Maryland, which is where I live. But it turns out that there's a terrible citrus tree disease in Florida, and to take citrus trees, not the fruits, but to take the trees out of the state is illegal. But fortunately, my mother lives in Florida, and so I took this tree to her, and she has been caretaking the tree for me and sending me pictures. And she certainly loves it. I mean, it is fun and fantastical, as you say, a little bit like Dr. Seuss, to have a tree with multiple kinds of fruit on it. And I should also say, you can do this with stone fruits. So you could do it with peaches and plums, for example.
Well, so having gone through this odyssey, learning about so many different kinds of plants and how they work and how to work with them, what has changed the most about the way you keep your own garden and the way that you think about plants?
Well, I would say that one of the most important things that I have learned is applicable to many gardeners who use potting soil for indoor plants. I had very consciously purchased sterile potting soil because I didn't want any bacteria or viruses or bugs in the soil. But one of the things that I learned is that it's very important to have a certain kind of fungus in your soil, and that fungus is called mycorrhizae. Mycorrhizae grow on the roots of 90% of plants, and they are very instrumental in pulling out nutrients and water out of the soil.
And Ruth, we're just about out of time, but is that fungus something that you'll find in your average potting soil?
As long as you don't get sterile potting soil, and you can also, even if you get sterile potting soil, you can buy some mycorrhizae to put in it.
Excellent. Well, Ruth, it's been fascinating. Thank you so much for talking today.
Thank you, Veronica, very much.
We've been talking to Ruth Kassinger. Her new book is called A Garden of Marvels, How We Discovered That Flowers Have Sex, Leaves Eat Air, and Other Secrets of Plants.